I'm Jamie Hurst, and for the MSU Denver Alumni Association, we're excited to bring you Bird Talk, a podcast about our alumni, their careers, and their lives.
I tell you, I have a lot of love for MSU, so I'm not mad. Okay. I've been loving you guys for 25 years.
Exactly.
It's nice to get some
You're
love back.
You're like, it's about damn time you started loving me back. I get it. Today's guest is Janet Damon, a 2000 history graduate, visionary educator, and a fierce advocate for literacy, well-being, and equity. With over 25 years of experience in Denver public schools, Janet has worn many hats: history teacher, digital librarian, literacy interventionist, and a community builder. Her work is rooted in a deep belief that education is not just about content delivery. It's about healing, advocacy, and unlocking human potential. Janet's story is shaped by a powerful family legacy. Her father, raised in Texas during Jim Crow segregation, and a mother who grew up in Korea, where girls were often denied education. It instilled in her a reverence for learning and service. That legacy lives on in Janet's classroom, which she describes as a healing space, a place where student voice, identity, and lived experience are honored. From mindfulness and art to digital storytelling and community advocacy, Janet's teaching practices reflect a holistic approach to education that empowers students to thrive academically and emotionally. Outside of the classroom, Janet is the founder of Afros and Books, a collective of librarians of color and LGBTQ+ staff promoting liberation through libraries, and Mix Mama, a vibrant community of mothers, artists, and educators raising compassionate global citizens. She's been recognized with numerous awards, including 2025 Colorado Teacher of the Year and the Horace Mann Award for Teaching Excellence here in 2026. Janet is an incredibly bright star in our Roadrunner community, and I cannot wait to go to school today. So welcome to Bird Talk, Janet.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful to be here.
And that is just like one third of the things I could have talked about. It's an incredible thing. And I know we've just met today, but like also core value of curiosity, lifelong learning. Mm. I have more degrees than could fit on the walls, right? I love being in the classroom. I'm good at it. I'm good at being a student. I love learning. I think I did the math real quickly. I think it's 63 semesters I've been an active student over my career. And so I'm good at this kind of stuff. But I'll tell you, I've never crammed as much as I've crammed this week to try and feel comfortable talking to you about all the incredible work that you're doing in the community.
Wow, that means
awesome.
A lot. And it's a kindred spirit. I love curiosity, and that's not a core value of my family as well.
Yep. I talk about it, and I'm sure people that listen to this podcast over and over are getting to the point where after three seasons and 30 episodes are like, Jamie, we know everything about you. Stop repeating the stories. But when you have a core value, like, it comes up and should come up in all the things that you do. But I've talked often at length about this idea that I can't imagine not being curious.
Yes.
How boring that must be.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And because I hear something and I'm like, well, I want to know more.
Yes.
I just inherently want to get into a space to be like, I heard this thing. Could that be true? Is it true? What else? What's the other side? And that like natural kind of like magnetism to critical thinking, I think is a valuable asset that I carry. And from all the things that I've learned about you, it seems like that's what you're doing in your classroom, which
absolutely,
is pretty incredible.
Absolutely. It's foundational.
It is.
Part of the human experience. And the more that we connect to that curiosity, the more that it can drive innovation, connection, excitement, and just continue to place us on the path of lifelong learning.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Well, great. That's our podcast today, David. Thank you so much. just kidding. So I don't know where you want to start. Do you want to start with your family? Because everything I've read about you, that does seem like it has been a very core piece of developing who you are. And it seems like such a fascinating story coming from a father right in the South during Jim Crow, and a mom that was from Korea, that where at that point in time, access to education for women wasn't a thing. So how did that all happen? And how did they decide to come together and be like, no, education's the path, and we're going to encourage that in our children and all that?
Well, you know, when I think about my parents, I think about these two beautiful lineages that I get to carry. Yeah. And one of them being my father, who, you know, he went to school when schools were segregated, and he also went to schools that he was loved and he was really cared for in those schools. So he remembers fondly like teachers who used to make sure they had enough to eat. And if they had to go to work that morning and then come to school, they made sure that there was water and a washcloth to clean your face. And so those acts of kindness and tenderness really impacted him. But I also think about these folks who might have had the opportunity and privilege to, for example, go to the library that my father couldn't go to.
Sure.
And there were librarians there, these bookmobile librarians who would get into these trucks and vans and they would drive down this dirt road to his little neighborhood mm-hmm. and he would be able to get a book. That experience ended up being very transformational for my father. So yeah. to have that book every few weeks and to read that, growing up as a child, my father filled our entire house with books.
Yeah.
I mean, he is literally the first librarian that I ever knew. And
yeah.
he was curating this collection. There were books everywhere. And every summer when I was growing up, he would give me and ask me, what are you curious about this summer?
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell him, like, I want to learn about, you know, anatomy. I want to learn mm-hmm. about, you know, history. I want to learn about this. And he would say, okay, let's get the book report going. And I would research and I would study it all summer and I would give him progress reports on how I was doing. And at the end of the summer, we would have this big celebration where I'd
yeah.
present all my learning and he would be so excited for me. I think about my mom. My mom, you know, she grew up in a family that was privileged. You know, they could read and write and they had been magistrates in this little town in Korea for a long time. And yet of her siblings, all of her brothers were sent to school
sure.
and she wasn't. And so my mother, instead of just kind of accepting things the way they were, my mom was like, okay, I'm going to go to the school and I'm going to advocate for myself and I'll clean. And so my grandmother was like, and my mom would go sweep the front of the school and they would let her sit in classes. Mm-hmm. But there was this story that my mother would tell us about, you know, how that felt mm-hmm. and how her first taste of inequality felt. So she got to go to school, but they wouldn't give her a desk.
Sure.
So she had to sit on the floor.
Ugh.
And she was so bright in math, all these kids would need her help. So they'd call her over to come
sit
help
on the
me.
Floor too
and
with
so
her.
Then, yeah. no, yeah. they'd let her sit
oh,
next to them
better.
On the bench. And one day a little girl looked at her and said, you like to help me because you get to get off the floor and you get to sit on the bench. And my mother, here she was, this person of privilege, mm-hmm. having this moment where she realized that a seat, mm-hmm. to sit at a seat, someone could use that and say like,
weaponize it.
And so my mother had this philosophy for us that no matter what, you would have resource for school, mm-hmm. whether it was pencils. Mm-hmm. She'd give you a pencil, but she'd also remind you, in some countries, to get a pencil. And so even now as an adult, if I walk and I see a pencil in a parking lot, I will pick it up.
You're like, there's somebody
remember.
That needs this.
Yes, this is important.
Yeah.
This took a treat. And so I think about how much not only they advocated for me to have a quality education and how much they were willing to sacrifice
yeah.
for that, but also that there was this idea, do not take it for granted.
Yeah.
There are places and people who are not allowed access.
Yeah.
And so what does it mean to be the bookmobile driver
mm-hmm.
who's providing access? What does it mean to be the school that's going to work with a young person who's like, hey, I want to come. I want to get my education. So I think that has always created this muscle within me that we have to move towards everyone having access to all that education can provide, from social mobility to personal development to self-actualization,
yeah.
which is the core of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we can reach our fullest potential and that we can meet ourselves in this identity that we choose through our education.
Yeah. Oh, I love everything about that. And what a perfect coming together of two worlds,
yeah.
right? And to find that shared kind of commitment to like, no, we can all look and point and say access to education and that experience that you have. Because
mm-hmm.
I see that often where, again, like I said, I love to learn. I love to be in school. I would be a professional student if someone would just pay me to right? My
dream.
Dad used to always joke. I remember he was at my law school commencement and he was like, all right, so like, what's next, Jamie? Like, you're not going to sit still for a little bit. I was like, well, he's like, it's probably a PhD, right? And I was like, well, I just don't want to pay for that at this point now. Like, no, someone would have to pay me. And he was like, you would be in school forever, wouldn't you? If someone would pay you to do that. I go, absolutely.
Yes.
So I understand that.
Yes.
And so I just think how wonderful it is that your parents saw that early on and was like,
oh, yeah.
okay. And then now, obviously, it sounds like you've incorporated all of that into your 25 years of teaching.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
But it's so interesting, too, because I think about the way that we frame things and the way that you framed your educational experience mm-hmm. was, I'm going to get poured into
yeah.
and I'm going to get developed
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to continue
mm-hmm.
my lifelong journey of being developed and growing. And I was recently at an event where there was another presenter and she's a CEO of a company and she's also an athlete. And she said, well, you know, what's interesting is like 94% of CEOs also played a sport.
Yeah.
And so when you think about like what it is to engage in challenge
mm-hmm.
and to see it as something that is a part of you that can always be fostered through commitment
yeah.
and development.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to approach that with my students. anything that you feel like, gosh, this is so hard, it just means that that muscle is a little underdeveloped and you're going to have this amazing opportunity to develop that muscle. And then you can see where that takes you.
And then the aha moment is that much better. I think about it all the time too. Again, college athlete, most of my staff, college athletes, because it takes one to kind of know one.
Yeah.
And you,
yeah.
But I've said it on this podcast before. Like, I was a softball player in college. It's a failure sport. If I fail 7 out of 10 times, so 70% of the time I'm failing, I'm an All-American. Right?
Hey, yes.
You hit 300.
Yes.
You're an All-American.
Yes.
That is such a different mentality than I think any other industry or type of way of being grown into something is that my expectation was I was not going to get it right the first time.
Mm-hmm.
My expectation was I could still have a good game and I could still perform and be a part of the team and we could still win even if I didn't get a single hit and I struck out 3 times.
Right.
And so it never was a reflection of like, oh, I'm bad. I can't do this. It's just, it's like, oh God, nope. I just got to get a lot better at seeing a rise ball. I got to get a lot better at, you know, whatever the case might be. And that mentality, I do think trickles into all those things so that I walked into any environment with this idea of like, well, I'm not going to be the best. Mm-hmm. So I might not even be good at this, but someone's here that is more of an expert that does have something. And if I let them teach me, then I'll get to where I want to go faster.
Absolutely.
Right. But I do think the older I've gotten, the longer I've been outside of athletics, the more I realize that not everybody had that approach or has that approach to things, that challenges and barriers are not a stop.
Right.
It's not a period. It's okay, well, let's either strategically figure out how we're going to get around this or figure out, do we need to muscle up and go right through it?
Right.
Or do we need to call in support to help us get over it? Whatever the case might be, there's a way to tackle obstacles.
Yes.
But if we don't learn that, and especially at a young age, it becomes a lot harder to learn as an adult.
Yeah.
Because those barriers tend to have a lot more impact.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I love that.
All these things that I agree with you on. You are kind of multidisciplinary. So you are in a librarian still. And you teach at Delta for 25 years. So DPS Public School. And for those people that don't know much about Delta, it is kind of a continuation or pathway school.
Yes, it's an alternative school.
Okay.
So it's school for students who have faced some challenges in our traditional high school setting. Yeah. And so some of that is because they might have had a parent or a caregiver get sick, especially during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
And so some of our students actually helped to support their family. So they went right into work. And we know that when students are trying to juggle like work and the pressure of providing for their family, it's kind of hard sometimes to keep up with your coursework.
Sure.
So it's a lot of factors. For some of them, it is the incarceration of a parent. Mm-hmm. It is the prices of housing have gotten so high that for some students, it's just housing insecurity. So a lot of factors that pull them to our school. But at our school, it's a mentality and a focus, everything that we have to do to make sure every student is successful. And that requires a lot of time to get to know each student, to find out what particular challenges they're trying to overcome, and what are their goals for post-secondary.
Yeah.
Are they wanting to go to college? Are they wanting to go into the trades? Are they wanting to join the military? Like, what is it that we can help support them in? And then to align them with mentors and experiences. They have a ton of field trips where they get to go to different colleges. They've come here to MSU quite a few times.
I was just going to say, we get them here, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing to see students at that juncture because usually they come to us when they're in the middle of their crucible, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I tell them all the time is that those high pressure moments is what truly is creating this diamond soul that they have.
Yep.
My students have some of the most compassionate hearts. They help each other. They want to see the world become a better place. They understand what it is to be at the intersection of exterior forces that are causing change and also to have to advocate for themselves. And that's one thing we really focus on is that, you know, even now, a lot of my students are losing SNAP benefits.
Yeah.
Some students are worried about their healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a moment for them to understand how we're also getting ready to vote. And we have students who are going to get to vote for the first time. And how all of these are intersectional pieces, right? That we have this voice in our democracy, but we also have to think about who is not being served, who is not being supported.
Yeah.
And is that the kind of society that we want to live in, you know, where we have such a gap and people who are suffering because ultimately they were the working poor.
Yeah.
And that's something that we draw attention to.
I think it's incredible. And especially at that age, that high school 14 to 20-ish age, where we're still developing our brains, we're understanding ideologies maybe for the first time, whether we've created our own or not, but we're understanding that they exist, to be able to provide a skill set and to talk so openly and proactively about advocacy and having some sort of autonomy that you are in control of some things when at that point in time you feel probably like you haven't been in control of a part of your world. Yes. You're a victim of circumstances when you're a child because it's just what it is.
Yeah.
And so to be able to start talking about those conversations about having advocacy, we're creating an entirely new generation whose response is no longer just going to be to get angry.
Right.
And I think that that is so important.
Yes.
I think, you know, as a child of the 80s, I don't know that we had those skill sets. And I was fortunate to be from a very stable family, good, you know, I was very privileged in a lot of ways that I, anger wasn't my resolve, but I was around enough people that when things didn't go their way and they didn't know how to even articulate their feelings or where they could go to do that, it turned into anger.
And I will say too, I think the hard part and the part, especially for marginalized groups, is that anger can turn within.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my students really, when they come, they are really exhausted and kind of beat down by a lot of things that have happened. But what I hear often from them is, I just didn't work hard enough. Our family, we just didn't do this. And we should have, because everyone can just get what they need if they just do this. And what we really bring their awareness to, too, is that there are things that are happening on many different levels that are impacting you. And one of the first things we think about is, how are you processing it?
Yeah.
How are you doing emotionally? So when we think about schools and students and mental health, one of the things I noticed, because coming to this role, I have worked in elementary schools, I've worked in middle schools, I've worked in high schools, I've worked with adults. And in this particular school, I feel like every single skill that I got in every one of those environments literally is the highest utilization of every skill, because every student is so different in terms of all of the factors, their neurodiversity, their emotional well-being. And I just noticed that a lot of the students had actually suffered from things like loss of a parent.
Yeah.
And losing your mom, especially at that time, it impacted so many other factors. So I had students who hadn't been to the dentist in 6 or 7 years. I had students who needed glasses and they worked in restaurants, but they couldn't read the menu to tell a customer, oh, this, you can substitute this for this. And it was like, being in a space, I'm a mother of three, to be able to also just to provide a little bit of maternal support and follow up, I realized just how many things can go wrong if you lose that support of that balance in your life of someone who's leaning in to make sure those things are happening. So then I realized, oh, well, I think a lot of times we look at students who are at a pathway school or an alternative school or students who are vulnerable and we say, like, they're just a rough kid or a bad kid or this and that. And actually quite the counter. These are kids who are – I have a student who when she found out about the SNAP benefits, she pulled up a map. We pulled up food distribution places and she was catching the bus to try to get those. And I was like, well, what can we do to make sure your family's resourced? So she won't know it by the time this podcast reveals, but, you know, we're going to provide for their family. You know what I mean? If you think about a student who's writing papers, trying to get the grades in, and also trying to find food banks.
Right.
At 16.
Right.
Right. There's a lot of people who, if they lost those resources, wouldn't know how to navigate that.
Yeah.
I realized that our students need even more of these skills. So there is this high accountability. There is this focus on it, because I realized, like, in order for you to make these transformations in your life that I needed when I also was young.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like, I want to be the educator that I needed when I was in high school. Right. And so coming to MSU was incredible for me, but it required so much navigation of things that I hadn't navigated before. And especially, you know, me and my brother, first generation college students, my dad did take a couple classes here though. Yes.
Because there's a lineage then. If your dad took some classes and you have a daughter who's an alum and one that's a student, right?
Yes. So what's funny is that my father took a class from my husband's father, who worked here at MSU as a professor.
How funny.
And my husband and I met here at MSU, and now he is a professor here at MSU.
Oh my gosh.
So there's so many connections.
So it is all the roadrunner.
Yeah, all the roadrunner vibes.
What does your husband teach here?
He works for the computer science. Okay, because I said I was going to not do this wrong. I thought, like, I'm your computer science. He's like, no, computer and information science.
Yeah,
it's,
CIS.
It's very different.
It's very different.
Okay, CIS is very different.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you do. You have a lot of ties that just run very, very deeply here, which is incredible.
Yeah.
I listen to you speak and I just think, what an absolute blessing to have people that are approaching education in this way, and especially in our community and in the heart of our DPS schools and with our students, to your point that we want to put them in a box and call them that they're challenging. Mm. It's not. It's that life has happened to them in a way that for many of us it didn't. And so we are so fortunate to not understand that. But life has happened to them. And so it may require a few additional things. And, and it's things that we didn't. As a 16-year-old kid, I never had to worry about where my meal was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a reality for a large population.
Yes.
And that we're able to create an education environment that creates a sense of safety and also the sense of, like, this is a resource for me. It's a place that I can go not only to learn and to feed my curiosity and to do all of those things that are going to help me, you know, but also a place that I can go for help, I think is something that more schools need to be doing. Something that I feel like we got very far away from when we got into all the standardized testing and what we're doing. We're going to school to graduate you, to go to a college, to do these things. And it's like, no, but what can school be?
Exactly. Right? For I think a lot of our students, one thing I see is incredible humanity.
Yeah.
So if we were to think of what is life, right? All of us are going to have experiences that are going to cultivate our capacity for compassion, our capacity for care. And I think about my students really as honestly elders in that. They have a sense of, I'll give you an example. So I took all my students on a field trip and we went down to Five Points as a historical walk, right? So we went to all of these historical places, and everywhere they went, people would come out of their house to kind of talk to them, and they could talk to anybody. Like, there's a fire department that was one of the first fire departments in Five Points to have African-American firefighters. And there's a gentleman who lived next door and was telling us all this history. The kids were all connecting. And after we finished the field trip, we go to right next to Blair Caldwell Library. There's like a park. And so we go to this park and we're sitting, and there are some folks who are unhoused and they are sitting as well. And at first they're kind of grumpy that we've arrived. They said, why'd you bring all these kids here? You know, And because they're doing something a little. And my students were like, oh, you have a basketball. Can we play? And so I had my students, they were playing basketball with these gentlemen. Probably gentlemen who people had not interacted or spoken to in a very long time.
Yeah. Probably not even made eye contact.
Fun. They had fun.
That's awesome.
And I witnessed that. Yeah. And to witness students creating the village, creating the space where all are welcome and equal. And one of my students who is Indigenous, he was talking about, we were, you know, just walking through the park afterwards. And I just said, so much of this land, you know, how it's changed and how it's changed hands. And, you know, he said, Miss, you know, you just have to remember that the land doesn't belong to us.
Yeah.
We belong to the land. The same way that your mother doesn't belong to you. You belong to your mother.
Yeah.
And so I think about how I really get to learn every single day from students who are incredibly connected to what it means to be
human. Yeah.
Right.
It is. It's a hard reality sometimes to think through this idea that we become more human and we become more empathetic and we become more compassionate after something is challenging for us or something hard happens. And we don't think about how policies might affect us or certain things that we take for granted until we have to go through it. We know that to be true as a society. And it is such an unfortunate thing that we have to experience and endure something before we realize we're capable of actually handling that and or being in a community in that space.
Yeah,
and so while there is clearly, you know, situational things that make the experiences of your students much more challenging, the fact, to your point, that they're kind of the wise people in the room. They're the elders in that space because they've put things together that some people won't learn until it's way down the road and they've missed out on years of being a good person.
Right. And when I think about myself, like in high school, people would have been like, oh, we don't know if Janet, you know, like what her trajectory is going to hold. You know, I was a good student, but I also was fortunate growing up. My father was in the military, so we lived all these different places in the world. But my father essentially was a naturalist. And my mother, they loved to go fishing and hiking. And I can barely remember a cartoon from growing up because every Saturday morning by 5 a.m., we were in the truck. My dad usually found a way to have a boat wherever we lived,
sure.
right? And so we were like in Louisiana, we would be on bayous, and Panama would be in the ocean, and we would go to these little islands, and I would just spend my day just enjoying the slow movement of nature. Mm-hmm. So, you know, coming to Denver, Denver was the biggest city that I'd ever lived in. And so we moved out to the far Northeast. We were living in Montbello. It was like, I was figuring out how to use buses for the first time. Yeah. Like it was a challenge. Mm-hmm. But one thing that was really cool is that coming to MSU, I met so many different professors who were like, I see all this greatness in you. I see this potential in you. And even my journey here at MSU, what I learned most about was myself.
Yeah.
And learning about the talents, the leadership qualities, and the capacity that I had to organize and do these. I became a community organizer for mm-hmm. a while here yep. and afterwards, and just helping people to get information that was going to be good for them and mm-hmm. help them and support them. So when I think about my students, a lot of what I also do is around what is the healing quality of this information, and how does this knowledge not only provide great knowledge for your family, but also how do you share this with the water yeah. community?
Yeah.
And so that's what they did with mental health. Mm-hmm. They focused on, you know, we looked at access to mental health, and a lot of my students speak Spanish, and they were looking at information that showed only 4% of therapists can speak Spanish.
Yeah.
And so they were able to do a lot of advocacy, raise awareness, but it also gave them an insight to, you know, I could benefit from
right.
this, right? When we found out, so we did an interview with Colorado Public Radio, and Rosina Schreer Santiago, who is the founder of Therapists of Color Collaborative, mm-hmm. heard it and came and was like, I have a grant from the state that provides,
awesome.
You know, free therapy for anyone who's been the victim of a crime.
Yeah.
And so many students were like, well, does it count if your car was stolen? Does it count if someone broke in one time? Does it count if da da da? And she's like, yeah, those are all crimes.
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
all of that counts.
All crimes.
And they got to experience what it is to have free yeah. access to mental health support. And I felt like the culture of our school changed.
Yeah.
There was this, students were using language that they hadn't used mm-hmm. before. And it's very transformative to have a knowledge of how your amygdala works,
mm-hmm.
of how mindfulness can benefit you, of how exercise and walking and going out for trees. So there's a lot of embedded naturalist things mm-hmm. in it that
yep.
really come from my parents, but also how do we make sure we create ways to share it? So that's where the podcasting came in
yeah.
and all these other pieces. It's like when you know better, you do better,
mm-hmm.
but you can also let others know
mm-hmm.
too, and they can do better as well.
I love everything about that. I have so many follow-ups, but they're in different areas. So one, mm-hmm. I'm glad you kind of explained the naturalist tendencies mm-hmm. because you do also have a nature-based book club.
Yes.
And so what I really would love to know, but it sounds like you almost answered that for me, is like, how do you see that pairing between books and knowledge
yeah.
and nature? And why is that such
yeah.
a good fit?
Yeah. Well, that nature club came out of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So around the time of the pandemic, I noticed that parents and children were feeling so disconnected.
Sure.
And when you think about fundamentally as human beings, we are social beings.
Mm-hmm.
We are social creatures. We also had to socially distance. And
yeah.
so I have always used nature as part of my support system
mm-hmm.
for myself. And so I said, well, let's go outside and let's just create moments for kids to connect.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am a librarian
mm-hmm.
and what people don't realize about reading is that reading also evokes the same kind of healing mechanisms that yoga and nature does. So, you know, even taking a minute to thoughtfully and consciously read something,
mm-hmm.
it slows your breathing down. It moves you from fight or flight
mm-hmm.
to rest and digest. So giving out books and stories connect
mm-hmm.
people as part of our human experience too.
Yeah.
For me, they were a natural pairing.
Yeah.
So we started to go outside. And I just remember like one of the first days, there was this little boy who connected with another little boy. And these two boys just were like running and touching the earth
mm-hmm.
and connecting. And he just runs back to his mother. He said, Mom, I made a friend. I made my first friend in almost a year.
Yeah.
Like he was so happy.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
also the parents were like, I needed this so much
yeah.
just to talk to one another and to connect. And then when you look at just what nature does for
yeah.
us, what it does for our mental health,
mm-hmm.
for our physical health, even being around trees, if you can be out in nature and walk under trees, trees will sprinkle you
mm-hmm.
with this natural sort of phytochemical that triggers your killer cells response. So you actually have a stronger immune system.
You are our second podcast guest that has talked about the power of trees. So Jonathan Stalls, who is an alum that we first met because we did a story on him years ago. It was right when I started, maybe 12, 13 years ago. He walked across the country.
Yes.
And so he's written some books on walking at 3 miles per hour or life at 3 miles per hour.
Yes.
And he just took me to school on like, Jamie, your body is actually made and your systems are in a way that we are supposed to be moving at the pace in which we can walk. So the fact that everything is now speeded up, that you're in a car, you're in a train, you're on a bus, you're on a plane, it's actually not good for your systems because they are actually built in a way to do this stuff. And so then we talked at length about trees and he's like, no, go outside and just stand and touch a tree for a minute, stand there. And so we had this whole discussion and I left by the end of it. I was like, well, I guess I'm going to hug trees now because all of this makes sense. And like, and so it was such
a fascinating conversation
because we don't think about those things.
Yeah.
And he's done incredible work with the idea that nature and slowness and absorbing things heals. He has turned that into a lot of advocacy for people that are mobility challenged to make sure that Denver is actually a walkable city.
Yes.
Because it turns out it's not.
No.
Sidewalks just end and there's not good paths to get to places and they're not plowed and they're not all this stuff. And so he does a lot of advocacy politically with that. He told me once he took a whole bunch of the Department of Transportation people that are actually designing our city on a walk.
Yeah.
And he's like, and I purposely took them on a walk so they could see the worst of this. But imagine if you are mobility impaired in some sort of way, or if walking is the only solution for you and it's in the middle of the winter and I have to go 7 miles to get to whatever. How am I doing this in this space?
Yeah.
And so it was just such a fascinating conversation. So I love that we're having another guest that is not necessarily in the tree and the walking space being like, no, Jamie, nature matters.
Yes.
You know?
And it matters for our students and for our kids and for them to understand why it matters.
Yeah.
You know, our physiology is wired for these things because we still have the same biology we had 32,000 years ago, right? Like, we were designed for connection and slowness and to be in beautiful spaces. Mm-hmm. And so, a lot of the families, it's been a few years now, and we have great partners like Highline Canal. We've walked the canal and Arapahoe Ski Basin.
Mm-hmm.
They bring us up for zip lining in the summertime.
How neat.
And so we're thinking of how to do some winter activities.
Yeah.
And not only that, but some of the students have interned then at the organizations.
Even cooler.
Yeah. So especially as they think about careers in conservation and stewardship, which is so important here in Colorado. So all of it, like it's
about
the wholeness.
Incredible.
Yeah.
For the first time ever, you have the chance to leave your legacy on MSU Denver's campus. During the Roadrunners Rise campaign, you can make a gift to reserve an engraved brick that will be installed outside the brand new student housing building scheduled for completion in 2027. Your brick will cement your support and dedication to MSU Denver. Visit msudenverbricks.com/shop to start paving your legacy today. This episode is brought to you by the writer of these bird jokes. He's such a silly goose. This place means a lot to you guys, which is pretty cool. So the first thing I do want to know is why MSU Denver? How did you land here in the first place?
Well, MSU, there's a lot of things that the campus offers. And I graduated from West High School, so you guys are very close.
Yeah.
My dad had taken a class here, so all of that kind of tied in. And it was affordable.
Yeah.
It was commuter school, and I did have to work. And so I was working at the public library downtown. And so it ended up being a very good fit for me.
And then why history? Just because the questing of knowledge and thirsting to know the things? Or did you just kind of land in it?
Well, I have always loved history. And I knew I wanted to be a teacher right off. So actually, the first couple of years I took courses, I just took courses that I loved.
Fair.
And so
to be fair, I was an academic advisor, one of my first jobs, like real adult job. And kids would ask me all the time, like, well, what should I take? And I was like, what do you like?
Yeah.
Because you're going to be way more excited to go to a class and be invested in the learning if it's something that you need to know. And most of these bachelor programs, you know, you have an allotment of 30 credits for electives. So use them to figure out what you like. Like, don't come in and just be like, well, I have to take this. And yes, you do have to do that stuff and you'll get there, but you might have a better appreciation for it if you just kind of start taking classes that you might enjoy.
Yes.
So I love that approach.
Yes, it was my approach. Mm-hmm. And so I was taking history classes, but I was taking so many like philosophy classes and women's studies courses. And so, so I just kind of landed in history, even though like it was what I would study. Most of my AP courses were in history. And so it was a good fit for me.
I get it. I have my original undergraduate degree is in religion. And it was the same thing. And like, I mean, and I grew up in a family that had faith, but it wasn't a primary cornerstone of who we were. Uh-huh. And I just remember coming home and my dad being like, religion? Like, what? And I was like, listen, it's fascinating.
Yes.
It's history, which yeah. I'm also there. It's philosophy. Yes. It is this idea of how we can rally an entire community, a culture, all these things around something that we can't touch, mm-hmm. right? And so the power of this idea of, and to me, it, without getting super philosophical and turning this into Jamie's thoughts on spirituality and religion podcast, it fills the need for so many of those human yes. needs that we have, which yeah. is like social belonging, community, identification, things that are going to help us guide our decision-making. So whether that's ethics or values or morals, yes. however you want to look at it. And that religion just did the most incredible job of putting it all in a system yeah. and saying, here's a way to satisfy a lot of those human yeah. needs that you have. And it's persisted for as long as I have. Right. So it was just fascinating to me. And I was at a public school, so it was not a theological-based degree. Uh-huh. It was like the science of religion. And so I took history classes, literature classes, anthropology classes, you know, social science classes, all that type of stuff to understand the impact and effect of religion on culture.
Yeah.
And to me, it was just, I couldn't put books down.
Yes.
And that was fascinating to
yeah.
me.
Yeah. It's such a vehicle for the transfer of culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I get it. Like you just like, I remember I got sucked into a couple courses and I was like, this is it.
And then when you lose time, mm-hmm. when you're not even looking at the clock and you could just be in a space
Correct.
Or a, yeah.
So you chose MSU Denver. Awesome. And then you had a daughter graduate from here.
Yes.
And one here now, right?
Yes. I have two. My one who graduated already, she went on both, actually, all of us went from our degrees here at MSU to master's degrees at University of Denver. And then I got my postgrad at UCD.
Yeah.
And so she's a special education teacher.
Awesome.
And she saw that there was a need for especially students who have been marginalized to have a voice and yeah. advocacy. So she started her own company, Sankofa Ed Consulting, and works to ensure that families know what justice should look like for their
yeah.
kids and what their children experiences should be. Mm-hmm. And she does that across the whole Front Range. And then I have a child here now who is studying nursing.
Okay.
And yeah, so she is just enjoying her experience. And so it's really sweet to come back to the campus, mm-hmm. even though things have changed a lot from when I was here before. I just have so many fond memories of just being mm-hmm. here on campus.
Well, what's great, so she's experiencing the new nursing labs too. So
yeah.
that's been one of those major changes.
Right now she's doing your Health Scholars program.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
She's just finishing up her last probably semester before she does that formal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But talk about a transformation. I mean, 12 years ago when I started, those nursing labs were literally in a room that was like fluorescent lighting, dark, like basement feeling. Mm. There was maybe three or four little gurneys that were set out that was in an open space. And it was just one of those things that it's like, we have one of the largest nursing programs in the state to the point that like we have to actually turn away people for
yes.
that program because we didn't have enough space. So when we got into this new thought process of what does the next 10, 15 years look like and our strategic planning and our campaign, we realize we need to really fix that, especially taking into consideration the needs of the health community here in Denver,
yeah.
especially with the populations we serve and all the things. So we were very fortunate to get a large donation from the Day family to build new nursing labs and then an entire new building that we'll be building shortly, breaking ground. I want to say this summer we break ground
That's
on the
insane.
Health Institute. But that'll be another building to localize all of that and get state-of-the-art technology. So I'm super pumped for your daughter to get an
yes.
experience of that. And I don't know if you've seen the new labs yet.
No, I haven't.
So there's like an ambulance bay that's there
gosh.
That then should practice and kind of learn all the emergency stuff in that space. The realness and how real it looks like the dummy. I mean, it's not a dummy. It's a mannequin of sorts that delivers a baby. And so,
oh my
like,
gosh.
It is so
wow.
real. But I'm like, what a great hands-on experience
yes.
that these students are getting in a safe environment so that
yes.
if and when mistakes will happen, we're doing it in a place that is, we're learning forward so we can stop the simulation and be in that space. So I'm excited to hear her experience of that.
Yeah.
But it is very, very cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That
That's
is awesome.
Awesome.
I do want to just make a point to list your accolades, which probably will be embarrassing to you. But this conversation has been amazing enough that people should be like, yeah, no, this woman's got it. What you've been recognized and the level at which you've been recognized is worth people to understand that we are producing incredible people that are being acknowledged for the incredible work. There's many alums out
yeah.
there doing incredible work. But the fact that people have stopped to be like, no, Janet's doing some really cool stuff. I just got to get through this. This is awesome. So the 2026 Horace Mann Awardee for Teaching Excellence. You were last year's Colorado Teacher of the Year. which is the teacher in Colorado to be acknowledged in that space. And then a finalist, actually, for the National Teacher of the Year. And I think there was, what, only four or five finalists in that space?
There's four of us.
2024 Extraordinary Teacher Awardee. 2023 African Americans for Making a Difference Award recipient. 2022 Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Humanitarian Award. 2022 Inaugural Making Our Futures Brighter Award. The 2020 Library Journal Mover and Shaker Awardee. And then you've also been the recipient of the Facing History Fellowship and Fund for Teachers Fellowship.
Yeah.
These are big deals, right? I would imagine you're not nominating yourself for this.
So
it's your students, it's your colleagues. Yeah, actually I am. Thank you. No, it's your students, it's your colleagues, it's the families of the students that you are impacting. How does that feel like when you get the call that's like, you know, you're the 2025 Colorado Teacher of the Year? That has to be a surge of emotions in so many places.
Yeah. It's so funny, though, because when a student had nominated me and when I got the letter, I was like, oh, I posted on my my social media. I said, oh, a student and some folks have nominated me and how wonderful it is to be nominated. And though I will not be completing the application, it is enough to be nominated. Mm-hmm. And so, like, 250 folks got onto my social and was like, what?
Girl,
and
you will. So
And people just went through all of these different things and ways that they'd been touched. And so, because the application is very rigorous, so you have to submit many things and they have to come out, they do a site visit and so forth. And so then I committed myself to it. So it was very shocking to me to become a finalist. And really, you know, it was the students and things that they said, because to be with someone, especially a young person during a difficult transition in their life, and also to be witness to 2 years
their
later when they are like, hey, this is the things that I'm doing. I feel very honored to do it. It is truly my highest calling. And it's the thing that gives me the most joy. As soon as I park my car in the parking lot, I just say a prayer of gratitude because I get to do this. I get got to my building safely and I get to go in and work with all these students. And recently with the Horace Mann Award, that's 5 educators across the nation who are recipients of that award. And you have to go out and teachers evaluate your practice. They need to experience. You have to teach something for them. So to even have been recognized like for that for 2026, it is such an honor, but it's a testament to the preparedness that I got while I was here at MSU.
Oh, way to bring it full circle.
You know,
there it is.
And I'll tell you, it's so funny. I went through 2 educator preparations here.
Okay.
Because the first one, when I did it with my undergraduate to teach history, I got to the very end and I needed to do 16 weeks unpaid student teaching. And I had a family, like me and my, like I couldn't. So I said, you know what? I'll work in libraries. I'm doing this community organizing right now. You know, DU accepted me into their Masters for Library and Science program. Okay, I'll be a school librarian. So I'm in my program and I'm working in DPS. I'm working at the library at East High School. And then I was working at Ashley Elementary's library. There was a shortage of librarians at that time. And so I got a call from Dr. Jody Gehrig, who was the Director of Library Services for DPS. And she said, hey, people have told me that you're in this master's program. People love what you're doing with the students. And I would like to see if you'd be willing to do an alternative licensure to be tutored. I said, well, I already have all my coursework for at MSU. She said, well, that's great because the program is with MSU to do your alternative licensure. So I was able to teach and do with this program. And Dr. Skip Jensen was like my, honestly, I feel like my, that program that I did with him was the most incredible preparation for teaching. And I think that's why my teaching practice was on a very firm foundation and the fact that I also had mentors, but I really do credit that instruction that I got from him as being really the cornerstone of a good practice.
That's incredible. I also do love that we have the alternative licensure space because it's solving a problem. Because you're not the first person that says 16 weeks of unpaid student teaching. I mean, many of our degrees, also outside of the teaching and school of education, they require internships. And the majority of industry partners don't want to pay internships. That's part of the fun is, we get unpaid labor. So we've been really thoughtful about finding ways to financially support our students in that place. So like from an internship standpoint, we have a Learn-On program where we fundraise money for so that we have a pool of money that when a student gets an unpaid internship somewhere, the university will actually pay so that they're getting those resources because our students are working other jobs. So to take that internship means you're going to stop earning the income that you're actually relying upon and whatever. And so, and School of Education, very similar. Our Dean of Education, Dr. Hind, We talked about this when she first started 9-10 years ago. Yeah. She was like, we've got students that are trying to complete their teach student teaching because they are called to be a teacher. They want to do this. They are so bought in. But in order to do that, they had to quit their job. So I've got a handful of students that are either sleeping in a car or they are worried about where they're going to get their next meal, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. How can we solve this problem? Mm-hmm. So we create a lot of emergency funding to be able to have direct student support to say, we know you need to do this. We don't want that to be the thing that you miss out on, which it is the thing. If you're dealing with, I need to pay my mortgage or pay my rent and I need to raise my children and I need to finish school. School is the thing that's going to fall off because it can. But it shouldn't be because it's the thing that'll have some more additional impact. But we can't ask you to choose. So we're just going to find a way to help fund that. And it has been so successful in allowing our students to then also be freed to have the time to be as dedicated and as invested in their student teaching and those classroom hours as they should to build that foundation you're talking about.
And I feel like that just gives a credit to MSUs. I feel like MSU is a problem solving campus.
It is
always thinking of what are some of the ways that we can really just think critically about what it is to support students. And I think it also goes back to the way you guys honor students and recognize that they have this complexity in their life. Many are working, many are commuting, just at different junctures of their life, whether they're a new to college freshman or whether they're someone returning to get a different degree or making a pivot. I just feel like there's this, it's like a little village within like a big city. Really, every time one of my kids is like, you know, I think I'm going to start here at MSU. I'm going to have this college experience and then see what I'm going to do next. I just get happy because I know they're going to be in this secure village of people who really care and are doing this not because it's just their job and role, but it's because it's some way matches authentically with what they feel like their calling is.
I appreciate that. And I couldn't agree anymore. I mean, I know that's what's kept me here in the space. And I do appreciate the ability to be problem solving here. I joke all the time, been here for 12, 13 years. I've sat on a lot of hiring committees, whether it's faculty, staff, you name it. And, you know, inevitably, a candidate will always ask the question like, okay, when we get to you, what questions do you have? A candidate will, well, at least 2 out of 5 times, will be like, well, what do you love about MSU Denver? Right? Not a bad question. They want to know this. And my answer for many years has been like, oh, I love this place because nobody tells me no. I go, and I'm not saying that in a way that I get away with whatever. Like, but I can come up with a crazy idea and say, you know what? I have this problem that I want to solve. Here's my solution. I've been thoughtful in thinking this. I've collaborated with. Can I try this thing? And if it fails miserably, like I'll own that, like whatever. But can I try this thing? And everybody will always be like, yeah. If that is a thoughtful, well-positioned, critically thought out way that we could address an issue that this campus community or this campus itself cares about, go for it. I mean, even something as simple as a podcast. Yes, it's a great thing. It's wonderful. We get to meet new people, but we put it on board to solve a problem, which was that we have alums doing unbelievable things. And we want to scream that from a mountain so people understand that, A, most of this city that we're in has been educated by MSU Denver. Right? We got 113,000 alums, 80% of which are living or working 25 miles from where we're sitting right now. So you can't go anywhere without seeing another Roadrunner. And if you take a look at all the people like your father who have just taken a course here, that number's over 500,000. We are educating a large portion of this state. And so I want people to hear those stories. I want to understand the amazing things that are going on. And so even at something as simple as a podcast, that is a crazy idea to solve a problem, right? And it's not a real problem. It's just a, you know, an opportunity. We sit around the room and the famous line from our president, Dr. Davidson, is always like, nope, everybody's on this side of the table. The problem's on the other. So it's not about this idea that, well, I'm saying we need to do this and you're saying that. So we're adversarial now. It's like, nope, we're bringing different perspectives to solve the problem, which is the thing that we're here to tackle. And so it has come up with some really innovative solutions for things and different ways to think about things. A, you know, alternative licensure program. That, no, there is a way to get a teaching license. You go to school, you do the things, you do this. And it's like, right, that's a great avenue for people that might not have barriers or, as we call them, zigzaggy lives. How do we find and support those students? A lot of the research, I think I read somewhere that you talk about one of your core beliefs as being the well-being, advocacy, and literacy that are keys to unlocking student potential. So it's not just about content delivery and how you do it, but it's about the holistic person, which is what we've talked a lot about today. We haven't talked too much about the literacy. And so I'd love to just hear kind of your work in that literacy space and then ask you if you know about our literacy research clinic and center that we opened here.
I don't know. I can say that right off.
But, well, great.
You know, through the literary society that we do, not only do we have these outdoor nature adventures that families can come to, they can get free books, we can talk about literature. But when we think about the lifespan of a reader, we want to have that engagement time when they're young and they're having just beautiful, positive experiences with reading. So we do some education around what happens in the biochemistry of a child when we pull them in for a good book, right?
Yeah.
So there's that, you know, all of these neurotransmitters of happiness, the oxytocin, all these things. And then also stories are a way to convey a theme or a lesson.
Yeah.
And so then we think about the lifespan of the adult reader. And so what we see is that things crowd out reading in a person's life, right? And so we think about reading in all of its dimensions. We can read the book, but you can also read a part of the book, or you can also watch a podcast about, you know, the author, and then show up. And we would do these brunches all over town, and we would just go to like a yoga class in the morning. Then we would meet up at a little spot nearby just to talk about the book and themes and ideas, because we want to just engage in that lifelong big themes that are happening, you know, love, death, change, triumph, trial. And those are conveyed through our stories. And it was just amazing to have elders come out for some of these events. And when we think about the current epidemic of loneliness and also people feeling very pulled apart and disconnected, right? So we think about reading as almost like this connective tissue that we're rebuilding or that we're pulling together the seams of our folks in our society to make sure that folks continue to have this social engagement, this rich dialogue, this critical thinking, and, you know, find home in community with the book. And so I love this moment in time, as you mentioned earlier, even though it feels like a lot is happening at once, it's offering this opportunity for us to live our values and to really be those folks who continue this legacy of, like, what is it to build community in the time where people don't feel like we have community.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Okay. You know enough about like the physiological responses to reading that I'd love for you to settle a debate I have with my wife often. Okay. I'm a big reader.
Okay.
Same thing, like stacks of books. She is also into reading, but she does audiobooks.
Yes.
And so we get in the argument all the time that I'm like, well, that's not really reading. I'm not saying you're not consuming information and you're not learning. I love that. But I try to express in some way, I go, but there's a difference to, and I'm not saying one's better or worse, but there's a difference than sitting there physically moving a page, reading the words and building that scene in your head versus I listen to audiobooks too, but when I'm driving and listening to an audiobook, it's not the same. It's not the same experience for me from a physiological standpoint. I'm not picturing it in my head. I'm not struggling to phonetically like read out a name that I don't know, but I've now created what it says in my brain. You know, all those different levels. So I never want to say that an audiobook is not reading. You're engaging with new content.
Yeah.
But there has to be some physiological difference. Or is
a
there not?
Bit.
Okay.
There is a little bit. You're both kind of right.
Yeah.
And so when you are listening to the audiobook, like you are getting this content, you are making connections, you are reading the book. But at the same time, to your point, when you have the physical book in your hands, your brain is doing something really cool in that your brain is actually building a map of the physical dimensions of the book and where those pieces are. So you can actually remember that, oh, if I go back to around here and you start flipping, because that's how your brain processes everything. It builds a map. It builds a map of the people in the room, who you can get resource and help. Who do you need to talk to when like something's happened and you need to go down the hallway? Your brain has a map of where do you need to go to get to that source. So you're right.
So
you're,
there's a little bit of
a little bit of a difference.
I know. I say it half and just because I'm never going to get angry at anybody that wants to consume information however you want to do that.
Right, right.
And I know for a lot of people that trip to work or sitting on the bus or whatever, like it is easier to consume information that way.
Yeah.
So I never want to shame anyone
and
in that space, but
the,
I do love the book.
The
and I love
the beauty
smell.
Of the book. Yes. Is the beauty of the book is actually, it also is connecting you to your own physiological response to awe. So the way that you just said the smell of the book, if that's a joy space for you, then that is going to trigger those joy centers of your brain, right? For someone else, it could be like when they're listening to the audiobook and it's so tense. And I have had this happen where I've had to pull off of a highway because what was happening was so, I was just like, oh my God. And so, but every single thing that we're interacting with, like I think about Octavia Butler's book, The Parable of the Sower, when she talks about what you touch, you change, yeah. and what you touch changes you.
Yeah.
So every experience is changing our biochemistry. Mm-hmm. We're always interacting with the world, with each other, with all of this. And the book can provide us this beautiful symphony mm-hmm. of sort of neurobiological responses yeah. based on what we're reading.
Yeah.
And so it is a way to just give us more joy and awe
true.
In a world
it
that
true.
It feels like we need to grasp mm-hmm. and hold on to those moments.
Well, I appreciate hearing because what I just heard is that I was right.
Yes.
So thank
yeah.
you. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. No, I, again, love reading all sorts of things. A lot more in the, like I have my pleasure fiction books that mm-hmm. are like my murder mysteries.
And then you're not going to ask me what book I am reading right now, are you?
I can if you'd like
no,
to
no,
know.
No, it's okay because okay. I am reading something by Jason Reynolds, but I can't think of the title right
okay,
now.
So that's then fine.
I was like, if I have to
fine.
Google it, let me know
no,
now.
No, that's fine. School should be so much more for so many students, and
yeah.
it sounds like you're doing it, and I'm just
yeah.
So
a lot of teachers are.
They are. They
pretty
are.
Pretty blessed.
They are.
We're pretty blessed. I almost meet more teachers who I have to remind them to eat
yeah.
and to breathe and
yeah.
to honor themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I really am on the lookout all the time for, because right now I coach teachers
yeah.
for signs of burnout.
Oh, yeah.
And so we do a lot of thinking about our human needs. Your human needs mm-hmm. are your first needs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you think about with our students, we're modeling. They're experiencing our nervous system.
Yeah.
They are experiencing our stress. They're experiencing all those things. So the things that we do for ourselves is essentially things that we're doing for our students.
Yeah.
So when you go for your morning walk, mm-hmm. when you make sure that you take a lunch. And so sometimes I'll hear people say, yes, everyone needs to make sure they're doing this. And I'm like, okay, but are you
are
doing
you?
It?
Yeah.
And they're like, absolutely not. I haven't had a lunch in 4 years.
yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm like, that's.
you gotta model
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when you think about turnover, I mean, it's really high. Like
mm-hmm.
when we think
oh, yeah.
about 20%, you know, mm-hmm. of educators and who is on the precipice.
Yeah.
Right. I think about just how fortunate that my school, my principal allowed me to do an entire year of, we did PD
yeah.
around what does self-care look
oh,
like. And
awesome.
I was able to bring in yoga teachers
mm-hmm.
and we were able to get a juicer and bring in folks.
Mm-hmm.
And there were folks who still ended up like,
mm-hmm.
I can't keep
yeah.
teaching. But we get better every time.
Yeah.
Like, we just keep making sure that there's iterative. You know, your human needs, that's mm-hmm. that's who kids need. They need good humans.
They do.
We're not robots.
Mm-hmm.
We are people. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. All right, so we're going to wrap up with my favorite part, which
okay.
is rapid fire.
Okay.
All right. Janet, what was your favorite MSU Denver memory?
All right, I just have to be honest. I did meet the love of my life here
mm-hmm.
28, almost 30 years ago. And we would sit out under the trees, under like they were like cherry blossomy
mm-hmm.
trees. And we would just between classes, just catch up. So every time I do come to MSU,
mm-hmm.
I just have this memory of all the love that I was able to connect with. And my kids have gone here.
Yeah.
So it's really a place that brings me a lot of joy.
I love everything about that. I assume you get our magazine.
Yes.
So this most recent fall this year was really an homage to our 60th anniversary. And I don't know if you read the article, but you should. It's the Holcomb's article. So
Aww.
Suzanne and Doug Holcomb
Aww.
Also met on campus,
Aww.
First two graduating classes. So they were here in 1965. And I think Suzanne got the AAs because right at the beginning,
uh-huh.
the associate's degree was there.
Right.
And then Doug stayed on. And so we finally got them to sit down and talk about
Aww.
Meeting on campus and what it meant to be a part
yes.
of that. And so every time I hear more of the couples that I like to frame as like, I met my mate at Metro State.
Yes.
It's at Metro State. But you met your mate at Metro State.
Yes,
and so
I
now
did,
just know we're going to come after you to be the next
Anytime.
People that we feature in that space.
Anytime.
That's awesome. All right. What does it mean to you to be a roadrunner?
I think roadrunners are adaptive leaders.
Mm-hmm.
They're trailblazers. They're innovators. And everywhere they go, they change the landscape.
Mm.
They change
that.
The entire culture because they bring such service and such humility and such really love of community.
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The last one. If you could put a billboard on campus with a piece of advice for all students to see, what would it say?
I would say the world needs your leadership, your service, and your spirit of innovation. Come discover all your talents at MSU.
Oh, there's our new slogan. Watch out. We're in the heart of our Changemakers campaign, which has been super successful and so great to be able to tell alumni stories and student stories through that. This idea that we want to be a part of what you become. And
mm-hmm.
I think we just mm-hmm. got the follow-up there, which is great. All right. So before we sign off, the last thing, you are going to be our commencement speaker this December.
Yes, yes.
So could you go ahead and just give us a prep of that speech and just get it? No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Have you written it yet, though? Or have you
well,
started thinking about it?
Let me tell you, what's so interesting is that there's a lot of things that MSU has inspired in me over the years. And this is truly a full circle moment because I love this campus and this community so much. And so to be there in that moment, to be able to talk about the things that I've learned since my time sitting in that arena and to think about what's the message that I want to linger. Yeah. So it's a little bit of advice, a little bit of inspiration, and a little bit of laughter all mixed in. And
that makes the best speeches, right? You got to have the serious. I mean, it's a serious thing. It's commencement. Yes. This is a very big day. So we have to have the pomp and circumstance.
Exactly.
But it also has to be real because it's MSU Denver. And we are real people doing real stuff in our communities. And then you always got to have laughter.
Oh, yes. Oh,
laughter is such a
medicine. There's a lot
of
comedy in 25 years of teaching.
Oh, I bet. I bet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The joy.
Yeah.
The joy.
So. Well, this has been such a delight. I am so very honored to be able to have talked to you today and hear about the incredible work you're doing. I'm not exaggerating when I say that list of accolades is probably just at the tip of the iceberg, but what you're doing and your approach and how you're affecting, especially our immediate community here in Denver. Yeah. Yeah. Please keep up the good work. Take care of yourself so that you can keep doing it because it is very, very impactful.
Thank you. And thank you for letting me come home to MSU to do this podcast with you.
We're super excited.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Bird Talk, special accommodation provided by University Advancement. Thank you to Brandy Rideout, production provided by David Sharman, and I'm your host, Jamie Hurst. Keep running, roadies.